Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, the usual doubleheader today. Andrew Bacevich will review the more than 7 decades of permanent war mobilization that followed the end of World War II. And Chris Brooks will report on the massive and distressing corruption scandal in the UAW. Andrew Bacevich is an interesting figure, a self-described Catholic conservative and West Point graduate who spent over 20 years in the Army. He's made a name for himself in recent years as a critic of U.S. foreign policy. He also has a Ph.D. in history and has taught at West Point, Johns Hopkins, and Boston University. He is now the president of a new think tank, the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, whose mission is to promote, in its own words, a new foreign policy centered on diplomatic engagement and military restraint. His new book, The Age of Illusions, How America Squandered Its Cold War Victory, is just out from Metropolitan Books. I must admit that I haven't read it, but I have read his excellent cover story in the March issue of Harper's, The Old Normal, Why We Can't Beat Our Addiction to War. Andrew Bacevich. You open the Harper's article with a quote from George Marshall. We are determined that before the sun sets in this terrible struggle, this is early in World War II, our flag will be recognized throughout the world as the symbol of freedom on one hand and an overwhelming force on the other. Now, that's an interesting pair of things to put together, force and freedom. What was Marshall thinking about with that quotation?
It is a striking comment. He made it in public, you know, to a class of graduating cadets at West Point in May of 1942. I guess the data significant in the sense that this is right really at the earliest stages of U.S. involvement in a war. Victory is by no means certain. We've got a long way to go. But I think he was positing a notion that in some respects offers kind of the master key of U.S. policy from that point going forward virtually to the present moment, certainly at least until the election of Donald Trump, and that is that as far as the United States is concerned, and not necessarily anybody else, there is this compatibility between freedom and power, that freedom, the fact that we represent freedom, we think, the fact that we pursue freedom, we say, that provides a justification for using American power. And that the use of American power, we claim, enhances freedom for ourselves, but also for all others. It is a concise way of explaining what Marshall and I think other members of the foreign policy establishment wished to have us seen to be about from that point going forward.
Marshall was not a cowboy. He's a very sophisticated fellow who then later, you know, became a civilian statesman, right? Very much involved in the post-World War II reconstruction of Europe. What can we say about, you know, how he fits in with that tradition that emerged after World War II? These are the people who are thinking of taking over the world, essentially, in the midst of this world war. Even in the middle of World War II, the American planning elite was very consciously planning how they were going to create a global empire.
Right. In that speech, for example, it does not include the word peace. Marshall doesn't say, we're fighting this war so that we can restore peace and maintain peace. So the ambitions that he's describing go far beyond peace. There is a rather explicit claim that as a result of the war, the United States is going to be globally preeminent. And that aspiration does inform U.S. policy from World War II going forward. It may well have been interrupted by the election of Donald Trump, but from 1942 to 2016, that's what we're about. We're about, from our point of view, using power to advance freedom. And because we represent freedom, gives us a justification for accruing power.
Now, of course, this has a long prehistory. First, you know, domestically, the U.S. colonization of much of the North American continent was an act of imperial expansion done with great violence, which has now gotten recoded in our history as a tale of heroism and great victory. But that attitude of the world is my oyster and it's mine for the taking has a long precedence in American history, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. The central theme of American statecraft from the founding of the Republic going forward into the 21st century is expansionism. That expansionism takes different form at different periods of our history. If we look at the story of the 19th century, broadly speaking, the expansionist theme is acquiring additional territory, developing that territory, creating an integrated economy from sea to shining sea. It's an astonishing story. It's a story of enormous success. It's also, as you suggested, a story of great brutality, as we have come to appreciate, I think, as we arrive at a conception of American history that is, you know, sort of less patriotic. When that project is completed, it moves into a different phase, and that shift occurs in 1898, Spanish-American War. This is really overt imperialism, as the United States grabs territory that are no longer part of North America, most conspicuously annexing the Philippines as a colony. And then when you fast forward all the way to World War II, Marshall is describing a new rationale for expansionism that is no longer tied to particular territories or particular markets, but has an ideological justification. And the ideological justification is that, he would argue, we represent freedom, and it's a freedom that we believe has universal application. We heard a lot of that from the so-called neoconservatives after the Cold War, and particularly after 9/11, when they were all jazzed up about invading places like Iraq. We're going to liberate the Iraqis.
What about the freedom to make money? Lots of it. How does that figure into the formula?
No, it's always there. The rhetorical justification for imperialism, not just by us, but by others, let's say the Brits and the French in the 20th century, there's always a claim that the quest for empire serve some larger purpose. You know, the French claim to be spreading civilization, for example. And yet when you peel off that layer of justification, yeah, it's about making money. It's about wealth. The Brits were in India and resisted allowing India independence because of the perception of British elites that having India be part of a British empire paid. Now, as a practical matter, that was not actually always the case. Our possession of the Philippines from the end of the 19th century until the aftermath of World War II didn't particularly pay. But we claimed that we had a mission to bring civilization to the Filipinos. And once you lay down those claims, it becomes hard to back away.
World War I presents an interesting interlude because the period before that were supposedly isolationists, though of course the adventures in the Philippines were anything but isolationist. But our myth was that we were isolationists, just concerned with matters within, you know, our own boundaries. And then Wilson gets involved in this European adventure, which did not turn out all that well. What motivated him, and what was the reaction to that that episode?
Well, he is truly one of the most fascinating figures in our history, in my judgment. Filled with contradictions. And at one level, he was a genuine idealist. And I believe that in his mind, the entry of the United States into World War I was motivated by his belief that this was going to be a war to end all wars, his belief in making the world safe for democracy, his conviction that with his 14 points, that the United States had a recipe for bringing about a peaceful world order. I think he believed that in his heart and his soul. And yet, and this gets back to your previous point, we had very strong economic interests for entering the war in 1917 when we did, because we had been loaning billions and billions of dollars to Great Britain and France in order to sustain their war effort. To put it bluntly, had Germany won the war, won the Great War that ended in 1918, it would have been an unbelievable economic catastrophe for the United States. So to some degree, we entered the war in 1917 in order to prevent that catastrophe from happening. So there is this mix of sordid motivations and idealistic claims. I think it was particularly apparent in 1917, but it figures in many other American wars, both before and since. But the key thing here is that all of Wilson's grandiose promises came to naught. We participated in the Great War, as it was then called, for a relatively brief period of time. It was only in the fall of 1918 that large numbers of American soldiers were engaged in combat against the German army. When the war ended in November, we had lost counting the influenza epidemic that was then just beginning, we ended up losing 116,000 American soldiers in that war. That's twice as many as Vietnam, at a time when our population was roughly one-third of what it is today. Catastrophic losses. And what did we get? It was not a war that ended war. It was not a war that made the world safer democracy. It was a war that led to the Brits and the French expanding their colonial empires. And the American people, rather quickly in the 1920s, came to the conclusion that World War I had been a terrible mistake, and that, therefore, Wilson's unprecedented intervention in European affairs, that's what our entry into the war was, had been a mistake and should never be done again.
Of course, popular opinion doesn't always count for much in international relations.
Well, it doesn't necessarily count for much in international relations, but it counts for a lot in presidential elections and in the election of members of Congress. And the point there is that as we get into the 20s and into the 1930s, there is a widespread conviction that U.S. entry into the Great War was a mistake and should never be repeated. That becomes politically very relevant with the rise of Hitler. You know, Hitler becomes chancellor in 1933. It becomes pretty clear as we go through the 1930s that he is a villainous character. He is going to embark upon a policy of expansion. Some Americans, by the time we get to, let's say, 1938, certainly by 1939 when the Second War starts, some Americans say loud and clear, this guy has to be dealt with. This guy threatens the vital security interests of the United States. But there were a large number of other Americans who said, hey, wait a second. This is the same song and dance that got us into the war of 1917, and that didn't work, and we don't want to do it again. Unfortunately, those people have ended up being labeled isolationists, and those people have in our foreign policy debates ever since, have kind of served as the great negative of U.S. foreign policy. Supposedly, there's always these isolationists lurking out there that want to prevent the United States from doing what needs to be done. I think that's all a load of malarkey, and one of the purposes of my essay is to make that argument.
Yeah, it's really more of a cuss word than it is an actual analytical category, isn't it?
Exactly right. It's a smear. It's a smear. It's as much of a smear as the McCarthyite smears of people on the left being called communist and soft on communism. In the late 1940s or early 1950s. It's a smear.
I'm speaking with the historian and foreign policy analyst Andrew Bacevich.
But during the 30s, the Roosevelt administration, partnership with the Young Council on Foreign Relations and people like that, were really planning on deep global involvement, even though on the surface we were still in this isolationist phase.
Well, I don't agree with you on that. I mean, I do agree that if we cite the Council on Foreign Relations in particular, that it came into existence an elite organization, a bunch of people that were New York lawyers and the like, who believed that the Senate's rejection of the Versailles Treaty had been a terrible mistake, who believed that the United States needed to play a global leadership role. And the purpose, not fully articulated, the purpose of the Council on Foreign Relations in the 20s and the 30s was to try to make the case for what they called internationalism. But Roosevelt, not so much. I mean, in many respects, Roosevelt, let's say from 1933 when he became president, probably until 1937, was largely a non-interventionist. Remember, we're in the throes of the Depression. His mandate, when he was elected and when he was reelected in 1936, his mandate was not deal with Nazi Germany. His mandate was restore prosperity to the United States of America. And that proved to be a heck of a struggle. So I think he was very much a latecomer. He certainly aligned with the interventionists, let's say by 1940, when he was running for a third term and was telling lies about your boys will never go abroad to fight another foreign war. He didn't believe that for a second. But the interventionist Roosevelt of, let's say, 1940 and 1941 does not describe the Roosevelt of 1936 or 1937. He underwent a a pretty sharp transition.
I was thinking more of people within the administration or around him in that milieu, and not necessarily Roosevelt personally. But then, you know, we emerge from 5 years of World War, and there is no peace. Decades of Cold War, punctuated by little hot wars all over the world. So that was what Marshall had in mind?
I don't think I would say that General Marshall in 1942, or even Secretary of State Marshall in 1947, had anything like a strategic blueprint. I do believe that he, like many others in the establishment, believed that America's time had come, believed that the withdrawal from the world stage that had happened after World War I had been a mistake, and believed that that should never happen again. Whether or not he had a blueprint, I kind of doubt it. The very fact that the aftermath of World War II led so immediately to the Cold War, you know, our Soviet ally suddenly becoming our principal adversary, I don't know that he expected that to happen, but certainly he was one of the guys who then had to deal with it when it did happen.
There's not much point in going through the Cold War now, but let's talk about when the great justification for that decades-long struggle, when the Soviet Union collapsed, there was not much of a peace dividend. There was no peace. How'd they keep it going? How'd they keep this, you know, this sense of permanent military mobilization, in the sense that, you know, that the U.S. needs to be active all over the world? How'd they keep that propped up with the adversary gone?
Well, in a sense, you're answering the question. In other words, there is this massive machinery. There are huge budgets. There are routines. There are people with ambitions, people with privileges, and they don't want to see that go away. So, I mean, that's kind of standard bureaucratic behavior. But to go along with that, there is the triumphalism of the immediate post-Cold War moment. As a kid growing up, I mean, I myself believed that the Cold War defined contemporary history. If something was not related to the Cold War, it didn't matter. And so when the Cold War suddenly ended in the fall of 1989, it came about quickly, abruptly, unexpectedly, and seemed to be sort of a cosmic triumph. And I think that a sense of hubris, euphoria, arrogance swept over the American policy elite and led people to believe, and here we get to the famous article by Francis Fukuyama, led them to believe that history itself had ended, that we had won, that our system now was destined to prevail, that there was no plausible alternative. And this attitude informed thinking among policymakers probably up to 2016, when Trump, denouncing these people, wins the presidency. So there's an element of self-serving that's a factor here. There's a choosing a convenient reading of history. There's buying into a set of ideas like globalization that people in the 1990s persuaded themselves was going to make everybody rich. It's a very sad and tragic story, and it all really comes apart then when our arrogance becomes a basis for wars like the ones that we have been fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan that have turned out so badly.
In a sense, that September 11th was a great gift to the militarists, because that allowed a whole new set of adventures. But here we are, you know, we spent, what is the accounting, $6 or $7 trillion, hundreds of thousands of people killed in these wars, immense disruption and misery all over. You think that the election of Trump in 2016 was a moment of popular revulsion against that model of governance?
My judgment is that political scientists probably would disagree. I don't think people voted for Trump because they thought he was going to be another Abraham Lincoln. They voted for Trump because it was a way of repudiating the consensus views that had informed policy during that post-Cold War period, beginning with the fall of the Berlin Wall. It was a way of giving the finger to the foreign policy establishment, to the establishment more broadly. You know, when Trump promised to drain the swamp, that's what people wanted to hear, because the swamp, the establishment, was perceived to be the cause of all the ills besetting American society. I think that's probably a greatly oversimplified perception, but I do think that the election really needs to be seen as a repudiation of the establishment, That doesn't mean the establishment accepts the repudiation. And, you know, it's interesting that if we take foreign policy, when Trump says, I'm going to pull out of Syria, I'm going to end these endless wars, it's interesting to just watch the pushback, you know, the pushback from inside the national security establishment, the pushback from the major media outlets, the pushback from conventional members of the Congress in both parties. 2016 was a repudiation, but those who were repudiated haven't given up yet.
In the final days of the Obama administration, Obama and Ben Rhodes were complaining about the blob, the whole national security establishment. How serious do you think they were about that? Those complaints? Were they really trying to resist it in any ways? And what precisely was their agenda that outraged the blob?
They were moving. They wished to move. They never pulled it off, maybe with the exception of the Iran nuclear deal. They wanted to be able to rethink certain relationships, such as between the United States and Israel, for example. They wanted to review the enemies list, which includes countries like Iran. But they didn't really pull it off. You know, even the Iran nuclear deal has now been undermined by Trump. I rather admire their instincts. I do agree very much, whether we call it the blob or we call it the establishment, but there is a set of institutions that constitute a network and a common way of thinking. I believe that that way of thinking was rendered obsolete by the end of the Cold War, and that the unwillingness to think about the way the world is changing and therefore the way that America's role in the world ought to change, that stubbornness, I think, has really hurt the country.
And now Trump and the blob. I mean, one day he comes off like he's, you know, the peacemaker who's going to resist the blob. The next day he wants to, like, blow up Iran. What do we make of his relationship with the blob?
The blob does value consistency, and Trump is inconsistent. The blob does value certain set agreed-upon habits, relationships. For example, I mean, a great example of that is NATO. NATO is badly in need of rethinking, and frankly, I think the United States ought to find a way to let the Europeans be responsible for their own security. But if you are part of that establishment, there's something sacred about NATO. So when Trump shoots off his mouth, the people in the establishment get upset. But Trump being Trump, it's amazing how rarely he actually follows through on the big talk. And we end up in a circumstance where I think most observers are sort of scratching their heads trying to figure out what U.S. foreign policy is at the present moment. When he was elected, everybody said, particularly responding, I think, to his use of the phrase America first, people said, aha, he must be an isolationist. We're going to totally withdraw from the world. Well, that hasn't happened. But on the other hand, neither has Trump, in my judgment at least, set anything like a coherent course for foreign policy.
So where does this all go? I mean, the United States certainly lacks the prestige that it once had. It lacks the limitless resources it once had. Our military is active in, what, over 100 countries in the world. Yet it seems like it's just not sustainable. Can this blob-induced model continue forever?
I doubt it, but it's going to continue for a while. I think circumstance will ultimately force change. We are going to have to reckon with the fact that China is indeed a great power, and the notion that we're going to be able to maintain the arrangements that existed in the Pacific after 1945, where we reign supreme, it just ain't going to happen. What's going to replace that old model, I don't know. I would hope there'd be some sort of an arrangement of power sharing, mutual coexistence, you know, something to avoid catastrophic war, at least. I think that probably the rise of a new problem set, climate change may well be one example. The coronavirus may be an example. Those things will undermine the notion that history has ended and sort of left the United States in charge. But the establishment is not going to go willingly. I just think that the course of events will bring about change. It might take a while, and I fear that it might be a little bit messy, but change will occur.
That was Andrew Basevich, a historian and president of the Quincy Institute, which is named after John Quincy Adams, who said in an 1821 speech that the U.S. goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. Of course it does, and that's the problem. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after musical break. Son of War by Laibach. Next, the United Auto Workers, which is in the grip of a major corruption scandal. Multiple federal indictments, some already ending in convictions, have revealed how the union became a subsidiary of the auto industry and the leadership lived high on the hog at company expense. We knew the union has spent the last 40 years giving into industry demands for concessions, but this level of personal corruption is enough to surprise even a hardened cynic. Chris Brooks is a staff writer at Labor Notes. He's written about the UAW scandals for In These Times and The Intercept. Chris Brooks. In one of your pieces, you cite an ad put together by the Center for Union Facts, run by the evil Richard Berman, and they were fighting the unionization effort at Volkswagen in Tennessee a couple of years ago, and he has this guy say, "I would not bet on the promises made by the UAW that they will protect you because they will eventually sell you down the road for their own benefit." Now, the problem with this is that it's 100% true, isn't it?
So a couple of things. One is you really got to set the tone for this ad that was running in Chattanooga. You know, the Volkswagen workers in 2019, I was on the ground. I'm actually from Chattanooga, Tennessee. And the closer you got to the plant, the more you were just blanketed with anti-union propaganda. So that ad not only ran on Facebook and YouTube, but it was running on the gas pumps right outside of the Volkswagen plant. So if you just, you know, pulled over to pump gas in your car, you were hearing an anti-union ad. When you stepped into your car and turned on the radio, you were hearing anti-union ads. And of course, you know, the line from employers is always, "We're not anti-union, we're just anti-this union," right? This is common in almost every campaign. But in this case, they were able to pull on things that were from the Detroit news that was happening just that week, you know, just in the past few months, which is that the UAW leadership has just been rocked, inundated with this massive corruption scandal going back several years, led by multiple federal agencies, where the top leaders have been found to be on the take from employers. So, you know, the employees that were, you know, trying to organize their union at Volkswagen were being told by the boss when they showed up at work that, well, if you unionize, we're going to shut this place down. And then being told by the media, well, even if you do unionize, the union's going to be in bed with the boss anyway, so you're not going to win anything. And this apparently created a convincing argument because the UAW narrowly lost that election for the second time. And, you know, and really, I think the workers there did a heroic job. And I personally would argue that even a bad union is better than no union. It's better than being at the just total whim of the boss because the local could organize for itself and fight for itself. But that argument is harder and harder to sustain when people are looking at the odds of either losing their job because of a plant closure or thinking that the union leadership is just rife with corruption.
Yeah, now I was actually pretty shocked by some of the stuff in your pieces because I'm certainly familiar with union corruption. But, you know, the UAW always seemed very willing to sell out the workers. But the level of personal corruption involved in this stuff was quite stunning. Give us the history of this. When did this this sort of thing get going?
So about 5 years ago, this multi-agency, you know, investigation got off the ground. It's being led by the Department of Justice, the Department of Labor, the FBI, and the IRS, and they were really looking at corruption in the auto industry. As a result of that investigation, to date, just this week, the 10th person connected to the UAW has been convicted in court. So what they found is kind of a series of crimes and conspiracies. So on the one hand, you've got a group of union officials that were involved in lucrative kickback schemes, where they were awarding inflated contracts to vendors that created UAW-branded swag in exchange for hundreds of thousands of dollars in bribes. So that's one group of officials. Another group of officials were just on the take from Chrysler. Three Chrysler executives have been found guilty of crimes as a result of this investigation, and they admitted in court that they were paying off the UAW leadership across the board in order to keep them, they said, quote, fat, dumb, and happy. And then, you know, to win further concessions. One of those was Iacobelli, who, you know, was a senior Chrysler official, and he told them, if you see something you want, feel free to buy it. And they did. What they did is they used the Chrysler Training Center, and the training centers are really at the heart of this conspiracy. They're a jointly administered and jointly run nonprofit corporation by the UAW and each of the automakers. They all have one, and they basically are just shills for the company to transfer millions of dollars to the UAW with no federal oversight, because they don't have to follow the same kind of Department of Labor regulations, which are pretty strenuous for unions, and they don't have to put it on their balance sheets, to the SEC or anybody else for the company. So through the training center, they gave out credit cards to all the senior union officials, and then they went out and used them to buy all sorts of things. They bought tens of thousands of dollars in shoes and shotguns and liquor. They literally would go for weeks and months at a time renting private villas in California, where they would play thousands of holes of golf. Like, I had no idea people could play so much golf until I read these court documents. Thousands and thousands of holes of it. And then at night they would party. And so, you know, it's also pretty incredible, because if you think about it, this is, you know, the people who are implicated in this scandal are former UAW President Dennis Williams, former UAW President Gary Jones, who had to resign in disgrace, as well as senior UAW International Executive Board members. And these folks would spend weeks to months at a time. So it's really hard to imagine that many people in Detroit working at a Solidarity House, the UAW headquarters, didn't know about this. Because if your union president is living for months on the golf course, not much work is probably getting done. And this has all been kind of borne out in the findings as well. And then, you know, they were also just like getting straight personal, you know, goods with this. So former, now deceased, UAW Vice President General Holyfield used training center funds to install a pool in his yard to pay for tens of thousands of dollars in first class flights. He even had Chrysler pay off his mortgage, over $250,000 on his home. So it's pretty shocking, the level of like personal graft that was taking place through the companies. But also, Chrysler just paid the salaries and benefits of multiple union officials for many years in order to help the union get through a rough financial patch. So, you know, essentially they became a subsidiary of the company. They would just transfer the union officials and say that they were working for the training center, and Chrysler was happy to make a political gift by funding their salaries. So, like, you know, all of this is pretty shocking. In fact, what I talk about in these Times piece that was just published is that on the night that bargaining began at Chrysler, the whole Chrysler bargaining team went out to eat at the Detroit London Chop House, which is this very fancy, historic restaurant, and spent thousands and thousands of dollars on booze and food, and all of it was paid for by their bargaining rival, Chrysler.
This is a real quid pro quo, right? The companies were buying labor peace, not that there was much trouble being made, but they were getting concessions and a friendly bargaining agent on the other side of the table.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, you know, I think that the way that I talk about this and the way that I write about it in these Times piece is that this really goes back to this devil's bargain, I think, that the UAW made coming out of the 1970s recession. You know, so the UAW once was the pace setter in the private economy.
Let's talk a moment about Walter Reuther, because he's an interesting character. He would talk Social Democrat at the same time he was purging the unions of Reds. So, talk some about the history of Reuther in the immediate years after World War II.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So many, you know, there's these, Bill Sarin has this, you know, he's a great New York Times, former Detroit Free Press writer. He has this great book, The Company and the Union, about the 1970 GM strike. And in it, he's interviewing all of these kind of guys from the sit down strike days. And they say, you know, we shouldn't call it McCarthyism in the labor movement. We should call it Reutherism, because Reuther really used the McCarthyist purge in order to just, you know, eliminate his political rivals in the union and to consolidate his power. And, you know, Reuther's a complicated figure, right? Because he was, you know, in favor of the civil rights movement. He did have, you know, a pretty progressive bent compared to a lot of other union officials during that time period. But he also was an egomaniac who really wanted to have singular control over the union. And part of what evolved from that is the creation of the Reuther Caucus, or what's often called the Administration Caucus today, which has been the ruling party, often described as a one-party state by dissidents in the UAW, that has held on to control in the union for the last 70 years. And basically every single senior official in the UAW, every president going back to the time of Reuther, has come out of this caucus. And that caucus is far more interested in protecting themselves than they are in doing what's best for the workers. There's just this vast gulf between the top union leadership and the rank and file. And they appoint all of these staff positions. They appoint all of these positions in the plants. And that's how they kind of consolidate their power over time. So even though the UAW, you know, I would argue under Reuther made huge gains for working people in this country, that GM, you know, coming out of World War II was the largest private company in the world. It employed the largest number of people. It was the largest consumer of steel, glass, rubber, and other materials. So whatever the UAW would win in their contracts would often set the standards for everybody else, steel workers, rubber workers, everybody else in this pattern bargaining. And they made really big gains. But Reuther never wanted to fundamentally challenge the broader structure of capitalism. He didn't want to challenge the idea that management could decide where investment was going, right?
Yeah, this was the famous Treaty of Detroit in, 1947, where they made this deal where the union would stay out of management in return for steady wage increases.
That's right. And they saw just this future of just endless growth where the union would come to the table. I mean, like, it's kind of hard to imagine today, right? But there was a time when unions would go to the table, and every time they went to bargain, they expected to get more than what they came in with, right? This process unfolded all the way till 1979, and that's where it really changed. You know, so during the recession, there's been an influx of foreign competition. There's the oil embargo, like all these things that are happening, and Chrysler is going bankrupt. So Ikakoka and Doug Fraser, then the UAW president at the time, go to D.C. to ask the government for a bailout, which, by the way, speaks to how important these auto companies are, the fact that they keep getting bailed out by the government when they go bankrupt, right? It's just this endless process in a volatile market. And in asking for the bailout from the government, the UAW agreed to over $1 billion in concessions from the company. And because it engaged in this process of pattern bargaining, where what they do at one company sets the standard for the others, so that way labor costs can't be a competitive advantage between, you know, Ford and GM and Chrysler. When Chrysler got these concessions, Ford and GM came to the table and said, well, us too then. And this just created this spiral that we've not gotten out of since then, where companies come to the table, even if they don't need concessions, even if they are highly profitable and they demand them and are willing to fight unions tooth and nail to get them. So this really set the trend. So the UAW went from being the pace setter in the private economy, really, you know, creating the contracts that set the gold standard for everybody, to being the first ones to start this concessionary trend that we're still in today.
There was some resistance within the union starting in the mid-80s, right? The New Directions movement, Jerry Tucker. Yeah, how'd that play out? The leadership was obviously willing to roll over and play dead, but some of the workers weren't so happy about it.
Yeah, that's right. So there's always been resistance, right? And I think it's these two tensions between like the version or vision of the UAW that goes back to the sit down strike, you know, where you had communists and socialists and leftists involved in that, really fighting for a democratic union, to this business oriented statesman, right? Like Reuther, where we cut the deal and you just accept it, right? And Jerry Tucker was this really important figure that emerged in the 80s in Region 5, which is actually the region where most of this corruption is coming out of, you know, so he's probably rolling in his grave today. But he emerged out of Region 5, and he, you know, initially was on union staff and was part of the administration caucus. And then he said he saw everything that was happening. He saw the concessions, and he said, this has got to end. The concessions have to end. We need to go back to becoming a fighting union. We need to clean up this mess. And so he ran against the administration caucus candidate. He was immediately fired from his job. He continued to campaign. And at the Constitutional Convention, where people are voted on, the UAW fraudulently had people vote against him that couldn't cast those votes, and he lost by 2/10 of a vote. The department, he appealed to the Department of Labor. It went 2 years through the court. They said that it was a fraudulent vote. He got a new one. He won it. But then he had less than a year to serve his term, and the UAW leadership from Solidarity House in Detroit, deployed all of these union staff into his district to campaign for his opposition, the administration caucus candidate, so he didn't win re-election. But Jerry really set this new trend, this new idea of, like, we need to build a new direction for the union. And local, officials were running for office all across the country in the hopes of trying to, from the bottom up, reform the UAW. It was the most vital reform effort in, you know, the last 40 years that's happened up until the reform effort that's taking place right now amidst this corruption scandal.
I'm speaking with the labor journalist Chris Brooks. All these years, these decades now of concessions, going on 40, no, actually a little over 40 years, they haven't really succeeded in stemming job loss, right? We've lost like 1 million union jobs in auto.
That's right, yeah. So the UAW went from a high in 1979 of 1.7 million, union auto workers to less than 400,000 today, right? Only 150,000 that even work for the big three. So the UAW keeps saying, well, you know, we've got to go along to get along with these companies. We have to continue to give concessions that way that they're, you know, they're competitive with the non-union foreign automakers. And that's going to help to sustain jobs. This clearly has not been the case, right? And those jobs have been lost through multiple different routes. Some of them have been outsourced or offshored to other companies. Some of them are just being split off into subsidiaries that then, you know, are having weaker standards. And then a lot of it is just speed up. It's just they're creating jobs by increasing productivity inside the plants. And that is something that the UAW has believed in heart and soul for a long time now and is one of the major drivers of job loss.
For years, I've been hearing about organizing the non-union parts suppliers. What are they doing with that?
Nothing. 80% of the whole industry now is non-union. So even though they've got this, this pattern bargaining with the big three, where whatever they win at one, the other two will agree to, it's not really setting a standard anymore in the industry, because you've just got, you know, now foreign automakers in this country are producing more vehicles than the big three are. And the United States is the heart of profitability in the global economy for automobiles. So, you know, so the parts are all, you know, tied in as well with these foreign automakers, and they're non-union. So the UAW has done a really bad job of maintaining standards in their own plants, and then a terrible job of organizing new ones. And this has created a total crisis for the union, but the UAW leadership has not been able to meet it, not just because they're bad at their jobs, but also because they were just completely on the take and spending months at a time apparently playing golf.
Now, last fall, there was a strike against GM that was somewhat successful. Where'd that come from and how'd that all play out?
Well, you know, many, many auto worker dissidents and some former officials, believe that it was more a strike about legitimacy. It was about, you know, rolling the steam out of the memberships. So that way they would agree to whatever agreement came before them, you know, and this was really coming on the heels of what happened in 2015. So in 2015, we talked about how, you know, they went out to that steak dinner paid for by Chrysler. Well, that same bargaining team went and they bargained a contract that was really bad. It didn't do anything to address two-tier. You know, this is coming right out of the government bankruptcy and, you know, proceedings in 2007 and 8, where it was really the first time they could begin bargaining and have a strike threat in order to push the companies. The membership really wanted them to address these two-tier wages and benefits. So after 2007, you know, basically the UAW agreed that any incoming auto worker is going to be paid at a dramatically lower rate. They're never going to be able to have a retirement. They don't have defined pensions. They instead they have a 401k. They have less supplemental employment benefits and all these other things. And everybody wanted everybody up. You know, they wanted to end the tiers. And so they brought a contract that didn't do that, and the membership voted it down. And the leadership was just astounded. They couldn't believe it happened. You know, they just saw plant after plant just voting no on this contract. And then they had to go back to the table, and they did bargain a better contract in 2015. So what happens now is they're terrified that the membership is going to vote down whatever they bring to them because they think the leadership rightfully is corrupt, and because they think they're in the bag for the leadership, and because they think that they're not really interested in pushing these companies. So they put them out on strike for 40 days, and they come with a contract that doesn't really change much, you know, about the fundamental framework of how they've been operating on, in the hopes that after living on $250 a week, the members would accept it. So the contract, even after being on strike for 40 days, which is pretty incredible, by the way, I mean, these auto workers were really out there on the lines, and they said that they were fighting for all of the workers that have been, you know, falling through the cracks of these divisions in the workplaces, you know, the temps that have been hired instead of full-time employees, the second-tier workers. You know, they really wanted to bring everybody up to the same standard again. There was a strong feeling of solidarity, and they ended up getting a contract that didn't really address those issues in any fundamental way, and they narrowly voted in support of it. I think a lot of people held their nose and voted for the contract, you know, based on the conversations and interviews that I had with many, many people, because they didn't really believe that the leadership would go back to the table to get anything better.
Well, now their steak dinner gravy train has been shut down. Do you think you're going to see any change in behavior from the leadership?
No, it's got to come from the membership. I mean, you know, the leadership is clearly just protecting itself. They think that this is a conspiracy by the government to destroy the union. They don't think there's actually like a fundamental problem with corruption in the top. They've not done anything to really significantly address the issues inside of the union. But luckily, the membership is stepping up. So, you know, so for the first time since New Directions, there's this whole new, you know, movement taking place among auto workers called Unite All Workers for Democracy. It's a network of auto workers across the country, and one of their first goals is to get enough locals to pass a resolution in favor of direct elections to call for a special convention where they could change the UAW constitution and make it to where one member, one vote, vote for top union leadership, just like they have in the machinists and the steelworkers, and just like the Teamsters got after the government was threatening to take them over. And this is really important, actually. You know, if the UAW doesn't clean up its act, if the membership doesn't show that they're ready and willing to take ownership of this union, and if the leadership doesn't take the right steps or, like, you know, big enough steps in the right direction to clean it, you know, to clean its act up, the Department of Justice has made it abundantly clear that you know, they've named the UAW itself as a conspirator in this. They plan to bring RICO charges, and you could see a government takeover of the union, which would be just horrendous under a Trump administration. They could appoint, you know, any anti-union lawyer, you know, from some union-busting firm to basically be in charge of it and responsible for the union's activities, you know, for decades at a time. So something similar happened in the Teamsters. Thankfully, they had Teamsters for a Democratic Union, this movement, you know, this caucus that built up, and they were capable of saying, no, what we need instead is one member, one vote, and they got it. So it's not a panacea. It's not a silver bullet. It's not going to fix everything. But the members organizing and saying, you know what, if given the tools and the resources to run our own union, we can do it. That's a great indication to the federal government that's the direction they should head in, rather than, you know, a direct takeover.
Yeah, you know, you look at the decline of the union over the last few decades, you know, loss of more than 1 million members, being reduced to near insignificance in the big chunks of the industry. Where is their instinct for self-preservation? Is it just that, you know, while they were getting steak dinners, they didn't really care about the long term?
I mean, it's a great question, right? I mean, you know, all I can say is that from the court documents and from everything I'm reading, kind of the internal communications that were happening, it seemed abundantly clear that they thought that their future was tied to that of the company's executives, right? That they had these relationships with them. There's just this totally unrealistic perspective on what it takes to fight and win in this current moment, right? And it's really a shame, because every plant closure in this country could be a referendum on corporate greed, right? It could be a conversation starter about how we have an amazing manufacturing capacity that could be building towards a sustainable economy under a Green New Deal, right?
Yeah, I was going to ask that question. I mean, there's not much thinking about that kind of thing going on, is there?
Very little, right? So the closest is, you know, General Motors, as a part of this contract that was just agreed to, closed a series of plants in North America, Lordstown, famously, but also in Oshawa, in Canada. And the Oshawa workers there, this rank-and-file group of workers, got together, and they actually, you know, paid for a white paper to be created, a study on what it would take for the NDP or some national group to come together and nationalize this plant and retool it towards sustainable production, you know, and then to get those workers back in there. And it was a really, like, brave and courageous and insightful thing to do, but it just fell on deaf ears. The union leadership is just not interested in it. And unfortunately, that's the state of affairs. Not only do you have corrupt leadership, but you have leadership that's really just stuck in this way of doing things. They think they should just bargain backroom deals. They should just, you know, cut deals with the company and try to survive another day, as opposed to projecting a vision for tomorrow, setting big, bold demands, and then going out on strike to try and win them. And, you know, as small and insignificant as the UAW in some ways has become, auto workers still have a ton of power in this country, right? I mean, you know, both cultural significance, but also real significance. I mean, you know, like, the entire economy is still largely based on the idea that people have to drive around, right, to work or to deliver the groceries in your store, or any number of things, right? You know, the interstate and suburbs, all of this is created on the assumption that you have a car. So the automobile industry, even though, you know, it's largely non-union today, it's still a huge industry. It's still really vital to the economy, and it could have tremendous impacts if the workers were to really leverage their strike power to be able to win some bigger picture things.
So what about this UAWD movement? It's just gotten going, right? How big is it? How powerful is it? What are their plans for the longer term?
Yep. So it's really new. It's nascent, right? It's just growing. They did a first round of trying to get these resolutions passed. They had to get a threshold of 80,000, and they set a date arbitrarily. I think they had kind of this expectation that the government was going to swoop in very quickly and take over the union. So they set kind of an unrealistic timeline for themselves. They were intending to get locals that represent 80,000 members to pass this resolution. They got, you know, up to 60,000, but then the timeline hit. So now they're doing round two. It's clear that they have the support and, you know, kind of the wind behind them to be able to get enough locals to pass this resolution. But then, you know, it's really a fight inside the union. Like, they've got to rebuild it, you know, plant by plant, local by local across the country. They've got to, you know, push out the administration caucus leadership or win them over to a new way of doing things, a new way of approaching it. Unfortunately, there's just not like a simple short-term solution, right, that's going to have to happen here. It's really going to take a lot of hard, long organizing work. But this is just such a crucial private sector union that, if they can do it, it could have just a tremendous impact on the labor movement overall. So they're having their first national meetup at the Labor Notes Conference coming up in April in Chicago, and they're building plans, you know, for the next year ahead, not only passing this resolution, but getting people to run for local office, thinking about how to map out their network, build more relationships, get more auto workers, including the over 45,000 graduate students that are represented by the UAW. Many people don't know this, but the UAW is the largest representative of graduate student workers in the country, and getting them involved in this as well. So, you know, they're in the beginning stages of beginning to think this through.
I was Chris Brooks, a staff writer at Labor Notes. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a relic of an earlier time, Part of the Union by the Straubs. Till next week, bye.
Now I'm a union man, amazed at what I am. I say what I think, that the company stinks. Yes, I'm a union man. When we meet in the local hall, I'll be voting with them all. With a head of a shout, it's out, brothers, out. And the rise of the factories fall.
Oh, you don't get me, I'm part of the union. You don't get me, I'm part of the union. You don't get me, I'm part of the union. Till the day I die. Till the day I die.
As a union man, I'm wise. The lies of the company spies, and I don't get fooled by the factory rules, cause I always read between the lines, and I always get my way, if I strike for higher pay, when I show my card to the Scotland Yard, and this is what I say.